All right, y'all. Welcome back to another podcast. This one in the very beginning of February. But for those of you that are keeping score, and I know some of you are, this is the second podcast in about a week. So hope you've enjoyed that. Give me some applause there. Yes, yes. Thank you very much. By the way, I hope you enjoyed that opening footage. If you are watching on YouTube, I do put in some video clips here and there throughout the podcast because it makes a little fun for those that are watching. But I had some nice beach clips that I happened to film the other day. So anyway, this podcast is, again, going to be a little bit different than what you guys are used to, but I think you'll like it. And I say that because I'm going in segments here, but I start with a segment where I kind of do a little bit of opining over by there. I like to kind of, you know, flesh out some concepts sometimes, you know, use some analogies, shed some light through the window of understanding over by there on a concept. And I've kind of seen some people doing a little bit of a panic lately, especially lately here. And I thought I would address that a little bit and give you an analogy there. And then I have a really, really cool segment that I'm going to post up separately. I may even put on the main channel because I think it's that cool, where I got to go over to Bethel Farms. That's the sod farm here that I work with in Arcadia, and interview the head of Bethel Innovations, which is their research arm, essentially, and something they've just started. And we started talking about regenerative agriculture, which is something, if you're a listener of the podcast, you know I've talked about before. So I don't want to tease it any more than that, but I'm telling you, it is a super interesting segment, something that caught me totally off guard the way it went. So it made the conversation flow in a very interesting way, and I think you'll enjoy it. And then finally, I kind of end up talking a little bit about the pre-emergent strategy, just kind of going over it, nuts and bolts kind of stuff. And then I end up asking the question, why have I ever never seen a disease problem on dandelions? With that, I hope you guys enjoy this podcast, and I'll see you at the end. So there's this concept I've been exploring. Sometimes I get weird thoughts in my head or analogies of things that I want to share to see if it sheds light on a subject in a way that could create a discussion. And I was thinking the other day, I'm like, people panic. It came up because of the cold weather, but we see this all during the year. People will tend to panic about things at different times of the year. Right now it's Florida, it's the cold. We've never gotten this cold in the last 40 years, somebody says, or something, right? We're below freezing for 33 minutes at midnight, and you know, the whole world is going to come to an end. People are concerned. Now, it also could just be the way that people express themselves online, because most of this I see on Facebook. Some people just, they write emotionally online, and they don't see it that way because, you know, it's different generations. It's a generational thing, possibly. But the long and the short of it is, it does seem like people panic over things, again, being the cold. Now, it'll also come all back around. You know, things come for full circle. People up north, in the spring, they're going to see purple flowers on henbit. They're going to think it's Creeping Charlie, and they're going to panic when it's really going to die like a month later. By the way, that was my favorite customer to sell back when I worked for True Green, just so you guys know. You know, we used to actually look at lawns, you know, back before there was an internet and all of that kind of stuff and ways to measure lawns. You actually used to run leads, and so I would find a lawn about March or so when the snow was gone, and I would see henbit. Now, you can tell henbit versus Creeping Charlie, they both have that kind of scalloped leaf edge, so that's why people get them confused. Little do y'all know, Creeping Charlie rarely gets a purple flower, actually, or ground ivy, it's also called. But they do look similar. The difference is henbit has an upright growth habit, and Creeping Charlie or ground ivy grows flat. The other thing I think people happen to see a lot is you'll see Creeping Charlie and wild violet growing together, and henbit. And so all of that blends together. But that was always my favorite customer to run across, because I was like, oh yeah, this person is going to have tons of weeds. We're going to come out and they're all going to die naturally. If you're not aware of why that is, yeah, I was a liar. Scoundrel. Hane, you're such a scoundrel. But the reason that is because henbit is a winter annual. So the seeds will germinate in the late summer towards the fall, and it'll start to grow in the lawn, and then it overwinters, and then in the spring it rages, flowers drop, seeds dies. I don't know what the temperature range is, but it doesn't like it real warm. So I'm thinking once you get a day or two over 80 degrees outside, I'm thinking the henbit kind of drops seeds and backs off. So what was I on? What else was I talking about? Oh, the concept of caring about your lawn too much. So yeah, panicking. People will panic over Poa annua. People will panic over any brown spot, anything they think is a disease. Oh my gosh, I got to throw down Disease X. And I'm probably partly to blame for the fact that I think people do run to the disease control too fast. Not that I've told people to do a bunch of disease, but I've done a lot of education on it. When you tend to talk about something a lot, people do tend to put more importance on it. But the long and the short of it is, I wonder if we should go back to a different look at our lawns overall and stop the panic. And I'll stop using the word panic because I don't think people are actually panicking, but stop being concerned over every little thing. I raised boys. And I was definitely not concerned over every little thing. And in fact, as they were growing up, I wanted them to experience some bumps and bruises and scrapes and getting stitches, you know, having a fat lip. You know, I wanted them to experience those things. It's good for them. Lets you understand, hey, I'm tougher than I think I am. And then the next time it happens, you get through it better. Maybe it doesn't even faze you, right? You want that lawn to do the same thing. Sometimes it needs a little thinning. Sometimes it needs to be put in check by a disease. You know, especially with St. Augustine grass, it gets so thick. It can get so matted and thick and dense that sometimes a disease can actually be a good thing. It can thin it out for you. And I guess that's mainly who I'm talking to here are warm season folks. Cool season folks, to a degree, your lawn can also withstand a lot more, but it doesn't have the ability to self-repair that the warm season turfs do. I should say, Kentucky bluegrass, yes, but not to the degree, not to the strength, not to the speed, and not to the success level that the warm season grasses do. That's not a cut on you. You just don't have to. You guys have winter in between as bookends to kind of reset things for you, so you don't need grass that can compete in that manner. Down here, the growing season is long, and where I'm at, it's year-round, so our grass is always under threat. The jungle is always trying to retake the land. Here it's the scrub palmettos always trying to retake the land. Anybody that lives here in this part of Florida, well, anywhere in South Florida, but Southwest Florida especially, we have a lot of those scrub palmettos here. And if you have land that sits for a long time, they'll start getting palmettos on it. It's kind of cool. So that's what we're always trying to do. Our grass is literally competing against that stuff. So our grass can repair. Well, it has that nature, that ability. The reason that you don't like walking on St. Augustine grass, right, is because it's tough, it's rough under your feet. Well, that exact same thing that you don't like now becomes a positive when it comes to being concerned that we got too much of a cold snap this last night and I'm worried my grass is going to be hurt. No, it's going to be fine. It's almost like, how about this? Some of the ways that people treat dogs. Now, I'm not a dog person. I'm a cat person. So our cats were indoor cats. They were babied. They were loved. All of that kind of stuff. I don't understand how people raise dogs necessarily because I've never done it, but I know there are all kinds of degrees of how people care for their dogs. Everything from someone that leaves their dog outside all the time, 24/7, to the person that's all the way up to the person that has their dog in a stroller over at the River Rue when they're getting their dance and their drink on. The dog is over by the table in a stroller. No lie. Downtown St. Pete, dog, stroller, heaven down there. I don't get this. I don't necessarily know that most of you that are listening would agree with either extreme. I'm not a dog person. Is it okay to leave a dog outside 24/7 all the time? I don't know. Does it have to have a doghouse? What's the dimensions? I'm sure there's rules now for this in the world as to how you have to treat your dog, especially if you're somebody that's on YouTube or Instagram, right? I don't know those rules because you can probably tell we don't have pets in my house. I have some new plants, but that's another story. But there are those different extremes, right? Now, I'm not saying to treat your lawn as the dog in the stroller or as the leave it out back and let it alone. I'm saying somewhere in the middle is probably a good idea. Make sense? That was a little bit of a, I don't know where I really went with that, except to stop being so concerned about your lawn all the time and sometimes just let things take their course and see what happens. Now, back to the raising children or raising dogs idea. You might let them experience some things, go through some pain. You might want them to have to go through that. But you know what you always do? You always keep them well fed. You always make sure they have food and water, right? You always make sure that they're clean or trimmed, cut haircuts, right? You don't let your kids go around shaggy. And so I would say our job is the same for the lawn. We're not leaving it out there to fend for itself like a stray dog. We're not throwing it out to the wolves or to the coyotes. We're at least giving it a fence and an air-conditioned doghouse, but we want to give it the basics that it needs to survive. We want to leave that dish of food out. So there you go. There's sometimes the ways I like to develop a topic. Sometimes I get way too serious about what we do, but you know, I love it, and this is how I make my living, so it's fun to explore it in different ways. I'll be interested to see if any of you even care about this, or if you want to expand on it in any other way. I'd be happy to see what you have to say in the comments. Mostly on YouTube is the place to be able to do that feedback. Or you can hit me on Twitter, at Alan Paul, A-L-L-Y-N-P-A-U-L, or just search Lawn Care Nut Twitter. I'll come up. You'll see me there. All right, y'all, so this next segment is going to be really interesting, but also really different than what you're used to. And the reason is because it wasn't even meant to be part of the podcast in the beginning, but it became something that I thought was much better conveyed in this long form content. So what this is an interview with Nick Green, who is in charge of Bethel Innovations. He's also the farm manager at Bethel Farms in Arcadia, Florida. You know, they're the sod farm. I work with them. And have worked with them for a few years. They've been friends for a long time. And I was at the TPIE, the Tropical Plant International Expo, as you guys know, a couple, two, 3 weeks ago. I was there as their guest, hanging out with them in their booth. I talked about that in the last podcast. And while I was there, they had this variegated St. Augustine grass, which if you're watching on YouTube, I'll put a picture of it up. And there's also a picture on my Twitter, on my Instagram, I think. Yeah, Instagram as well. But the long and the short of it is, when I was there, I was like, this is really interesting because I posted that picture of the variegated St. Augustine grass and the reaction that I got, especially on Instagram, was very intriguing, I would say. As well as, and that's from our lawn folks, as well as the reaction, though, at the show from Tropical Plant people was very interesting, this variegated St. Augustine grass. And I thought, man, I want to go out and get some more content on that, right? Maybe I'll do me a viral TikTok with some variegated St. Augustine grass. Get me on the TikTok over there. That was dumb. So I went out there this week to go ahead and get a little bit more footage of that. Ended up that footage didn't turn out real well because we just got that freeze. And so I'm going to wait and go back to get some better stuff. But while I was there, I ended up talking to Nick, and he was telling me all about Bethel Innovations and what they're doing there. And this became something completely not what I was expecting and turned out to be completely awesome and educational, and I really wanted to share it with you guys. So let's get into it now.
My background, I'm from Manatee County. I think you live in Parrish, right?
I do, yeah.
I grew up in that same area.
Oh, nice.
So that's where I'm from. I went to UF, studied turfgrass science for a bachelor's degree. Got a master's in turf breeding and genetics. After that, I went to Johnston Seed Company in Oklahoma, where I did their Bermuda grass breeding. And then after that, I moved home, built houses for a few years, and then I came on with Bethel Farms about 3 years ago.
Awesome.
So I'm in charge of the production here on this farm. And the newly started Bethel Innovations. So that's going to be breeding, production research, new chemicals, some interesting brand new ways to kind of grow the sod crop, what I call sustainable sod. So we got a lot going on.
Okay, so I want to interrupt right here just real quick because you heard Nick mention the word sustainable sod, and I want to give a little bit of context here. That goes into, and we're going to start talking about here, you'll see, what is known as regenerative agriculture. And if you guys remember, I talked last year about a Netflix documentary called Kiss the Ground. It's narrated by Woody Harrelson. And actually, John Perry and I did an episode of this podcast where we talked about it. And it mentions a lot of that. And that Netflix documentary got me thinking about a lot of things. It kind of got me to mull on some things and still does. And so it was very interesting when I was out here at Bethel Innovations, and now Nick is starting to talk about how they are doing using those concepts with sod production. Now, let me explain something, and you're going to see it takes me a minute to realize what he's saying because I wasn't expecting this conversation to go where it did. But when we harvest sod here in Florida, we leave what are called ribbons. So they go through and they cut out the sod, and we do everything in squares here, not the rolls like you might see up north. and they're cutting the squares out. Well, when they go to the next row to cut another line of squares or another row of squares, they have a machine that does that. They leave a ribbon. It's 3 inches wide maybe. And the reason they do that is there'll be these ribbons all through the field. Those grow back together to form the next crop because our crops, our grass here, which is going to be Bermuda, Zoysia, St. Augustine grass, and then to an extent, Bahia grass. I should say, Bahia grass! Didn't want to disappoint. Those grasses spread by stolons and rhizomes, and they creep across the ground. So you don't need to reseed a field after you harvest the sod. You just let the ribbons remain, and they'll all grow back together within a matter of months. Now, that is something that I need you to picture as he starts to describe this form of sustainable sod production.
Yeah.
And then also the green strip over there is part of the sustainable sod program I'm trying to run, kind of a carbon sequestration, soil building, regenerative agriculture, sustainable, as opposed to just a more intensive agriculture. So trying to get the soil biology back up, soil organic matter back up, gain the benefits of cover crops, reduce N, P, and K, inorganic inputs, and just kind of grow a more sustainable, environmentally friendly, cheaper, less production cost system. So that's actually a really cool thing we're working on now.
So the idea is instead of having to use synthetic NPK 3-4 times a year, whatever you're doing, you're just going to use what's already in the soil and keep building the soil so you have less inputs?
Correct. Yep. We're looking for about a 50% reduction in the N, P, and K, the inorganic fertilizer.
But no loss in grow time, because that's part
correct.
Of the idea, right?
Yeah. Two stipulations. Can't take any longer to grow it, and it still has to be the Bethel quality. Mm-hmm. So we can't slack on those two components.
So what are you doing to improve the soil? Are you chopping and dropping something? I mean,
cover crops to start with are going to do a lot of things for the soil. Keeping a living root in the soil
right.
12 months a year is the key to this kind of program, that regenerative ag. When we harvest and we just have ribbons, we're at 96% fallow.
Right.
And just so there are no living roots. You're prone to all kinds of, overheating of the soil, poor water holding characteristics. The fertilizer you do throw down will not get taken up if there's nothing there to take it up. It has only one way to go, and that's down or washing off the top. But that's going to capture a lot of those nutrients, put them back into the soil. We get some soil compaction because, we can't work the ground most of the time between sod crops. So that soil compaction just builds and builds and builds. So we get things like radishes that are going to go down and have a high capability to break through a high PSI soil. Uh-huh. So they can reach down and break that up, bring those nutrients from the hard pan back up to the crop, create channels for water infiltration, a lot of things.
So are you planting in between the ribbons? Is that the idea?
Yeah, directly behind ribbons. We try to get the cover crop out.
So while it's growing in, you got something else in there.
Correct.
And then at some certain time, you yank that out and
correct.
Has that ever been thought of before, ever?
I think it might be the first time ever. Inside, I think in Florida
it took me a second to understand.
It's pretty cool.
I'm like, it's really interesting.
It's a common thing. It's nothing new. And that's actually ag from way back, before we got greedy and intensive.
But we blame corn for that and soybeans. But what I'm saying, right?
All agriculture can,
I'm joking,
can be
but
run
it's just,
in a number of ways.
Yeah.
But in Florida sod, I have not heard of anybody doing it.
So like I said, it took me a minute to get it. But then once I did, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. You're literally going to be planting other crops in between those ribbons. And while the ribbons are growing back together, those crops are growing in there, keeping a living root in the soil, which again helps the soil to remain healthy. Not as much is escaping. It's reducing compaction, all the things that he's talking about there. But just at the right time, you got to get that crop out of there. Either you mow it out, you spray it out. He talked about bringing goats in to pull it out. And then the sod crop grows back together, and bam, you're out of there. That is really cool.
So three different ways to destruct that. Well, four maybe. That's a cool season crop. We could just let that go when it heats up.
Yeah, it's gone anyway.
It's going to check out. We start mowing it, knock it down, checks out. You might have some lingering growth in there that might be a problem, but some herbicide cleanup at the end is nothing. It's not an extra step. Mm-hmm. We're going to keep the fields clean towards the end anyways. So you can just naturally let them check out and mow them. We're going to do some actual just mowing to knock them down. We're also going to do chemical application, and then I want to get some goats out here and just
see what they do.
Close off a 40 by 40 block and put some goats on there. They really help break down that material. Runs through their gut, you get that breakdown process, and then the manure goes right back in. I don't think a goat manure pellets would be invasive in the sod crop. I don't think we could do cows, because you'd have a big cow patty that would then be on the pallet, you know, 6 months later. But those are kind of the techniques we're going to...
So the idea is the goats wouldn't eat the St. Augustine, but they would eat the rye that you put in between, or...
you'd have to pull them off soon enough. I think they would preferentially eat the cover crop first. But if you left them out there and they graze it to the dirt, they'll graze it to the dirt. I've seen goats eat labels off of gas cans that you couldn't pick off with your fingernail, but the goat just sucks it right off that, you know, because they'll eat. I think they'll eat it all. But yeah, you'd have to just pull them off at the right time. Mm-hmm. But that gut process and going through, I mean, that's how these grasses were, how they evolved and originated, right, was in conjunction with grazing animals.
Yeah,
that was some of the selective pressure that forced the meristem to the ground, as opposed to being the apical meristem. So that's how grasses kind of evolved with the animals over the years on the prairies. So they want those. They want that reaction. You know, you get different bacteria when there is a animal in the saliva and the chewing and all that. You get all the beneficial bacteria. So
another question I was thinking about is, well, what if it contaminates the sod? And that's why I would have never thought there would have been this strategy in a sod situation, because you want pure grass, right? If you're selling Floratam St. Augustine grass, which this farm does a lot, you want that to be pure. So it seems counterintuitive. It actually seems against your natural instinct as a grass lover, a turf lover, especially I'm assuming as a turf grower. It must be against your natural instinct to put anything foreign into that soil, even if you know it's an annual crop that's going to die as soon as the temps get over 85 and humid or whatever it is. Even if you know you have a reliable, you know, low input that you can spray it out with, even if you know you can mow it out, whatever, if you bring in goats. I mean, it's cool, but it's also scary, right? And so that's why I could never picture this. And of course, this has been done for years and years and years in other crops, but it took me a minute to get it there when it came to sod production. All right, y'all. So that concludes the first segment of the conversation that I had with Nick Green out at Bethel Innovations. I hope that was interesting to you. It was super interesting to me. I actually have a couple other segments that I think I can get from our conversation, because we talked a little bit about their breeding program that they're going into, as well as some tests that they're doing with some other soil amendments and things like that. So I'm going to try to go ahead and do the same style there, where I kind of take our conversation, chop it up, add a little bit of context in between, and see if we can't get some good information out there, because I think this is really interesting, and it's definitely interesting to me and something I enjoy doing back research on once I've left. I've got all kinds of different terminology like apical meristem that I've been doing research on and learning more about the grass plant, the way it grows, so I can understand a little bit more about what they're doing out there, because I think it's, like I said, really cool. So hope you guys enjoyed this segment. Leave me a little bit of feedback and let me know. All right, y'all, so I'm back for another segment, and this time we're going to go into pre-emergence. It's going to be something we're going to talk about quite a bit over the next few months, different ways we can break it down. That's the nice thing about the podcast, is I can break down pre-emergence in a different way, talk, you know, deeper on subjects, stuff like that. So the first thing I want to do is just review the pre-emergence strategy that I teach and kind of go a little bit in depth into that. And even though it's a lot of you guys have been through it before, it's always good to review, because it just gets your mind starting to think as the season comes in. So I actually talk about what is called a split application strategy. And what that means is, for pre-emergence, again, a pre-emergent is a herbicide you put down prior to weeds germinating. Pre-emergent. You're basically defending against weeds. And in the case of spring pre-emergence, the number one goal that we have is to stop crabgrass. That's really what it's about. So we even call it pre-emergent for crabgrass, even though the pre-emergent we use, which the active ingredient is prodiamine, that'll stop other things too. That'll stop other weeds as well. But crabgrass is really the main one. And prodiamine is the gold standard. It's what most professionals use. It's the most affordable, the most accessible, and it just works. Okay. With that, then, we put down two applications of that product in the spring. Now, some of you are going to choose to use, and I have some notes here if you see me looking down. Some of you guys are going to choose to use the granular product, which is what most people do because it's just the easiest. It's what we all understand. It's the lowest barrier to entry because you just literally need a spreader in the bag, and that's it, and you can go. And that granular product that we have, that goes down at 3 pounds per 1,000 square feet. And again, that's 3 pounds of the actual product per 1,000 square feet. So if you have a 10,000 square foot lawn, you're going to need 30 pounds of product for each application. Now, so there's two in the spring that we're going to do. Now, you might also want to do liquid. If you're going to do liquid, then we have what's called a WDG formula, which stands for water dispersible granule. Basically, it creates a suspension. And the way you're going to understand that is you get to spray it as liquid. So you mix it into a pump sprayer, battery sprayer, I recommend. And you put that in there. You mix it all up. Each gallon of product covers 1,000 square feet, and the rate is 5.2 grams. So of the WDG, it looks like a powder. It's 5.2 grams per gallon of water, and that 1 gallon of spray mix covers 1,000 square feet. So if you had a 10,000 square foot lawn, you're going to need, I don't know, whatever 5.2 times 10 is. I always get in trouble when I do head math. So 5.2 grams times the 10,000 square feet. So 52 grams that you would need of that. So that's the basic strategy or the basic products that you could choose from or the different methods, all kind of blog posts I've written on that and stuff. Now, the strategy behind when you apply these two applications in the spring. The strategy that I use is based on soil temperatures. There are lots of other ways to do it, including looking at signs in nature. We've talked about when the forsythia bloom is one way to do it. If you're up north, I'm not sure what the equivalent would be down south. I don't even want to speculate. I'm sure I've looked it up before. But the long and the short of it is you can use nature signals and or you can just use an actual thermometer and you can dip that in the ground at 3 inches down and see what the soil temperature is. There's websites you can use. Obviously, we've always used the Greencast tool, we called it, Greencast Online. That's a website you can go and type in different areas where you live and dates and stuff and see soil temp. But what I've done is put it into an app for you. So basically, you just pull out your phone, which I should have mine here to show on the podcast. But basically, you pull it out and the soil temperature appears right on your screen. And that is the 24-hour average soil temperature for your home address. Unless you didn't put in your home address because you don't have to, you can actually just put in your zip code. Then it'll give you the average for your zip code. But that's the idea, right, is those soil temperatures. Now, what are now that you know how to track the soil temps, and the app is called Yard Mastery, a lot of folks have the app just for that. They don't even really use it for anything else. They don't use it for the journal. They don't use it for the fertilizer calculator. They don't use it for, you know, our suggested applications or any of that, our program. They use it just so they know what the soil temp is. That's fine. You can do that. But the idea being, now that you know when the soil temps are, now you're like, okay, well, when do I throw down the app? So there's two apps in the spring. Each one of those apps, I don't know if I told you, is going to give you about 3 months of pre-emergence protection. So if you're using the granular, it's 3 pounds per 1,000. That gives you 3 months of control. Or if you're using the WDG liquid, then it is 5.2 grams per 1,000. And again, 3 months of protection. But we need more than that because the germination of crabgrass happens all throughout the spring, even into the summer. So we need more than just 3 months of protection. That's why we do two applications split up. And the first one we do is as soil temperatures are crossing 50, heading to 55 degrees. Again, I told you all the different ways that you can track that. I like using the manual thermometer. The problem there is it's not the same soil. The soil temperature will fluctuate between the middle of the night and the middle of the day, for example. So you go on a 24-hour average just to kind of get yourself in the ballpark. That's what the app does for you. And also the websites do that. But the idea is once you're crossing 50 and heading to 55, that's when your first application goes down, 3 pounds per 1,000. The second application goes down a few weeks later or as soil temperatures cross 60 heading to 65. So that's your two milestones, I call them, soil temperature milestones in the spring. Soil temps cross 50 heading to 55, bam, app number one. Second application, soil temperatures crossing 65 heading to 70, that's your second application. So those are the two. 50 to 55, 65 over to 70, somewhere in that range. Now, do you have to hit it perfect? No, and you might even hear me misspeak. Sometimes I'll use the calculator or the numbers wrong. I'll say, you know, cross heading to 50, crossing 55, or I might say heading to 60, crossing 65. I get it. I say this all the time and in different ways. The long and the short of it is it's that window. right around 55, right around 65, 70, all in that window there, that is when crabgrass is germinating, between that 50 to 55 all the way up to that 65 to 70. That's the window. And you want to get your two applications down in that window. You want to get your first one down at the very beginning or before that window, and the second one down during that window. That's kind of how the strategy works. You're not going to always hit it perfect, though, and I don't want you to panic if you don't. Sometimes what will happen is you will you'll be late for whatever reason. Maybe you have a business trip. Maybe kids have baseball. Maybe you get busy with whatever. I don't know. All kind of things happen, and you don't get it down. That's okay. That's why it's a window. Just get the applications down in that window. Think about professional companies that are out on the road, right? They know the exact right time to start, but they have thousands and thousands of customers to get to. And some of those customers get to get their application at the first week that they start, some the second week, some the third. But the professional companies all have very good luck with crabgrass. And that is because it's a window. The other thing to realize is that not all crabgrass seeds germinate at exactly the same time. It's not like this is such perfect science that they all go, okay, that's it. Soil temperatures are crossing 55. Bam, let's all germinate. No, because some are 4 inches down in the soil profile. Some are further higher up in the soil profile. You know, there's moisture differences. The soil is different. The conditions are different, shade versus sun in different places. So there's a lot of area, a gray area there. And so it's really kind of impossible to hit it perfect. So that's why you just want to be in the window, in the ballpark. Think of it like a field goal. You don't have to hit a field goal by splitting the uprights perfectly in half. You can hit the field goal by hitting far to the left or far to the right. You still get the same 3 points. Now, the other thing to think about over time is that crabgrass does reduce. And I don't talk enough about this. I think I mentioned it a few times last year, but you know, if you think about it, crabgrass reproduces by seeds. It's an annual, right? And so that annual germinates in the spring. It grows all summer. It rages into the fall, pushes out seeds. Sometime around the fall when it starts getting cold, it drops its seeds and it dies. That plant dies, leaves a hole. The next year, that leaves area for those seeds to germinate, and you can see how this process just continues to get worse and worse. Well, if you stop the spreading of the seed, then you can actually stop the spread of the population. You can actually take the population down to very, very minimal. And so it doesn't take but a couple of years for that to happen, because I don't know the exact science behind crabgrass seeds and how long they can sit in the lawn. I've heard people say they can sit in the lawn up to 10 years dormant. I don't know anything about that. Somebody can tell me if there's truth behind that. But for sure, they can sit dormant for a few years, a couple, 2 or 3 years. And if that happens, you got to think about it. If you can prevent the majority of crabgrass plants in your lawn by using prodiamine pre-emergent for 2 years in a row, you will have reduced the amount of seeds by a very large percentage. Probably somebody's done studies on this exactly. I don't know if it's done in test plots or if it's done in real home lawns, because I always have a little suspect about test plots, but because there's not real world condition. But the long and the short of it is, just from me seeing and from me working with customers in cool season lawns on the south side of Chicago for many, many years, and understanding this lawn's been on our program for 3 years. This one's been on the lawn. We had some in Chicago for 28 years. Those were always fun. This one's their old original Kim Lawn customers, or this person's been on 6 months. This is their first year. So I can look at different times of the year. And I did, when I'd be out on routes and running service calls and things like that. Those are the types of detective work that I would do for customers. I'd be like, all right, how long has this customer been on the service? How many applications have they had this year? What was the timing of those applications? Especially, this is, again, when I'm trying to diagnose like a crabgrass problem in a lawn, like how can I help this customer so that it doesn't continue this way? You know, sometimes they would get their first application and then they wouldn't pay their bill. You got to pay your bill within 30 days or the account goes on financial hold. And so if that happened, we wouldn't go out and spray the next application until they paid. Well, if they didn't pay for 60 days, they had 60 days in between their apps. That can affect things. So I would look at that. I would also look at conditions of the property. I would also look at other lawns around. What do they look like? Do they all have similar problems or no? Are there other lawns in this neighborhood that we treat? What do those look like? How long have those been on the service? And what are their lawns look like? All these things. And you can do the same kind of detective work too. And that's why I recommend you use a lawn journal, upload photos. You know, when you have a really bad year of crabgrass, take a bunch of pictures, upload them in your lawn journal in the app. And then the next year, pay a little extra attention to that area. Make sure your application of crabgrass pre-emergent goes down there very well and that you are sure that you're making a, you know what I'm saying? And then take pictures the next year and see, watch the problem be reduced over time. So I'm starting to ramble here a little bit, but the idea is that after that 2 year mark, you probably won't have as much of a problem anymore. And a lot of folks will stop using pre-emergence almost all together, or they'll skip a year or two and then go back or whatever. We can talk more about those strategies as we move forward. So I hope that was a little bit of good information there for you on prediamine, crabgrass, stuff like that, a little something to get you thinking about it a little bit more, a little bit differently. But as the theme of this podcast has been, please never panic over it. To be 3 weeks later than you wanted to be is better than being not doing an app at all. So applying 3 weeks late is better than not doing it all. Applying 4 weeks late is better than applying 6 weeks late. Applying 6 weeks late is better than applying 9 weeks late. You get the idea, because not all crabgrass seeds germinate at the same time. It's a window. We want to get our application, or we want to get our treatments down within that window to the best of your ability, to the best timing that you can. Last thing I want to say, especially aimed at those of you that have done a seeding before and you've had it fail. We see a lot of times on Facebook and stuff, people show their successful seed jobs, and I love that. It's great. But there's just as many or more that fail. And sometimes it's not always your fault, right? Sometimes the weather will come, you seed the lawn, the weather will come, wash things away. You get a hot spell, a cold spell, a freeze, a frost, whatever, kills your seedlings. You have a watering issue, you can't get things watered, whatever it is. Animals come in and tear things up. People run across the lawn. The mailman drives across, whatever, right? All these things happen. Not to throw shade at mailmen. Totally did not mean that. And mail ladies. But the idea being, something always happens. Well, I want you to think about that with crabgrass also. Do you think that every crabgrass seed that germinates lives? No, that is a plant that is germinating from seed also. And sure, we think about, well, it's put there naturally, so it must do better. Probably yes, but maybe not. The idea is that the weeds have problems too. Sure, I could write a poem. Did you know that weeds have problems too? It isn't just your lawn. It affects all living plants, all green things. But yeah, they have problems too. So think about that as well. If you're a little bit late, it's okay. Nature's going to kill off some of those plants for you too. Probably with the case of crabgrass, it's probably going to be a late frost or something. Some of that early germinating crabgrass will get zorched by nature. It kind of makes me realize too, like, you know, I've never seen gray leaf spot or Rhizoctonia brown patch, large patch, or necrotic ring spot. I've never seen that on dandelions. Isn't that a shame? All right, let's move on to the next segment. So you tell me, have you ever seen disease on a dandelion? And if you have, please tweet me a picture, because I would love to celebrate a diseased dandelion. I'll end this with a story this week. I used to do something for my reps when I was at True Green, and I'm talking mostly when I was in sales. And we would always celebrate when the dandelions came, because dandelions were gold, right? Dandelions meant the phones were going to ring. Dandelions meant all the people telling us we're not interested or telling us they do it themselves. All of a sudden, a sea of dandelion hits, usually right around Derby Day, first Saturday of May, typically, or the week before that. And that's usually when the big sea, big flush of dandelions come, and that's the gold rush for us. That's when we made all our commission. So I would always want to hype that up. We'd say, get the fire in your belly. Well, it was really, we want them dandelions here, man. Come on, bro. Come on, Mr. Sun. Let's get those dandelions going, son. And so, you know, so we would get excited about that. But what I would do is I would challenge the guys. The first person who could bring me, now we had door-to-door salesmen, but we also had, this was later on, but even in the early years, we had guys that would go out and run leads. So they were actually out on lawns. And so I would say, any of the outside reps, we had outside and inside reps couldn't play, sorry, second-class citizens. But the outside reps, anybody, the first person that brings me a dandelion flowered, fully flowered and opened, that person would get a $25 spiff. That's what we called it. And we just put $25 extra on their check, right from True Green. Slush fund. And boy, that became a fun contest, to where one year a guy named Jeremiah Higgins stopped in the middle of 294, the toll road, over there, somewhere above Midlothian, I believe, you know. Anyway, because the way that the it's a highway, it's a toll road, so it heats up, right? It's all concrete, so it heats up, and it's always under construction, so cars are always going slow, so that means the exhaust is heating everything up all the time too. So this is a very hot highway, and you have to pay to drive on it, which is always a wonderful thing. But a dandelion had germinated in the middle of 294, like out through a crack, and Brohammer jumped out of his car on the way to work or sitting in traffic or something, and picked this and brought it. And so he brought a flowered dandelion in like the middle of February in Chicagoland. All for that $25 risked his life. So I guess we all do what we got to do sometimes. So I hope you guys have enjoyed this podcast. And I plan to bring you another one. I like doing the segments this way. And I like giving you some fun little video throughout, again, if you're on YouTube. And yeah, so I hope you guys have a great week. I hope wherever you are, the sun is shining on you. That's what I always say on Instagram. And I'll see you in the lawn.